It's still like a postcard out there, isn't it? It's just beautiful. And yes, Luke, it's beautiful, even though it's cold. Man from California, it's going to freeze this weekend. You know, so often we like to pretend things. We really do, and we convince ourselves of whatever. So a lot of times someone will come and ask me how my health is. I got some health issues, and I'll say, how's your health? And I'll think, well, I haven't been to a doctor for a long time, so fine. You know, nobody's telling me anything else. I mean, I haven't had any blood tests. So the guys that really know haven't said I'm doing poorly. And not only that, doctors have a tough job. They have to be honest. I mean, I remember when I had my first heart issues, you go in and I said, yeah, I have trouble losing weight. The doctor said, well, eat less. Oh, yeah. Like, you don't understand anything. But maybe he did. It's kind of interesting. The normal in our culture has been something that has changed so through the years from the Leave It to Beaver or Father Knows Best era. It's hard to watch anything, even on television, and not see a bunch of stuff that violates what God says we should be filling our minds with. The way it really is often different than what it should be. And in fact, one of the rules you understand is that cultures cannot tolerate deviant behavior. There's not a culture in the world that can tolerate deviant behavior. They have to normalize it or eradicate it. Those are the two things they do. So if you're in the Hitler regime, you have to normalize hating Jewish people, right? Or you have to stop hating Jewish people. But you can't do both. And in any culture that you've ever been a part of, that's the way it is. In any family, that's the way it is. In any church, that's the way it is. You cannot accept deviant behavior. So you only have two choices when deviant behavior shows up. Either tolerate it, make it acceptable, or eradicate it, make it unacceptable. But you can't just do nothing, because doing nothing makes it acceptable. And any culture does that. You take a look at the United States of America in different ways. At one point, abortion was a thing that was not done. It was evil. It is very acceptable today. And likewise, homosexual marriage or whatever else it might be. How does it happen? Because we cannot handle deviant behavior. So we either have to normalize it, and then those who say it's normal, I mean, those who say it's not normal become the new deviants that we don't tolerate anymore. See, and that's the cycle that always happens. So whether we like it or not in the church in America today, we are in a cycle that basically says there are issues and principles that we know about, and we're not paying attention to them. And if we're not paying attention to them, that's deviance. So either we got to make it okay not to pay attention to them, or we got to call it out as deviant. See, that's the issue. We don't want to call it out as deviant, so we make it okay. And sometimes we think just the silence is, see, I didn't approve that. You did by silence. You know, how many people watched the Jewish people get gassed in the chambers and said nothing? Your silence approves something. There's interesting verses that give us principles. In Galatians 2:20, what is the standard here? I've been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith. These are principles. See, when we become a believer, we become one that's identified with Jesus. Our lives are no longer just for us. And we live by faith. That's principles. So what happens when we don't do that? We're silent. We make a new norm that somehow we can be a part of this Christian thing and not do this. I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave his life for me. See, this is the standard. This is something the Apostle Paul lived like and gave us the example. But we've somehow said, you know what, I'm not quite up there yet. You know, it's interesting. That I was looking at a video that was kind of interesting on YouTube that was about, it was actually Boddy Bachman, a black preacher, was talking about how interesting it is in the church how we destroy people by putting them into ministry. And what he meant was this. Some young person comes up, some young man or young woman comes up, and they're really, really into the Bible, into God, and the first thing we tell them is, you ought to be a pastor. Well, how about a plumber? Why is it that the standard now, if somebody knows the Bible, loves God, walks with him, Why is it that he has to be a pastor? Isn't that the norm for all of us? You see, what we do is we have this mind frame. There's this group, and there's this group. I'm in this group. Really? How about being in the group you're supposed to be in? And by the way, it's the same group for everybody. Hey, it's not for the pastor to be one who has more faith and reads the Bible more and loves people. And we all should be that way. You see, so it's kind of interesting. When we look at things, we say, well, that was the Apostle Paul. And that's the standard that Paul had. Really? Perhaps. But the way it really is, and those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. Really? You know, something drives us all the time. Something does. It's either your feelings, your emotions, your something's driving you. Money, fame, something's driving you. The Bible makes it clear that as believers, as those who really know what they're talking about, it's God that drives them. And that's, well, I'm not there. Maybe you should be a preacher if you are there, I guess. Or maybe that's the standard for all of us. Maybe God made us a certain way, and when we malfunction, it doesn't work anywhere. And we can see that in the fruit of culture. We can see the misery that's out there in culture, the children that have been abandoned, the people that will use other people for their own good. But what I want to do this morning is kind of go through symptoms. When I go to the doctor, I have to go through symptoms often. And the doctor will help me understand some of the things. And some of the words I want to use are simple. I keep wondering, okay, when somebody gets converted, if we use that word, from a pagan lifestyle, and I know those are such offensive terms, but for the sake of humoring me, I'll use them. When they're converted from being pagans, what does that mean? What are they converted from? When somebody comes into a church, somebody that's not a believer, they're not a Christian, they come and they sit in our church and they're comfortable in it. How can that be? We're talking about things that should make them very uncomfortable. You see, it's not about comfort. It's about representing who God is, and God alone is comfort. And what's interesting is if we're going to be converted from non-believers, then what do we look like when we're converted? From what to what? What is an apostate? Well, apostates are interesting. It's an interesting word. Oops, go back there. Apostate is one who, play with me here. All right. Is a person who renounces a religious or political belief. In other words, they hear a principle, but they renounce it. So God says something, say, I'm not doing that. You know, let me read something to you. John, 1 John 2:15, do not love the world or the things in the world. Who said that? Now we understand that this is God's word, so he said that. Now remember last night I told you there were warnings, and God, when he looks at us, he's able to say, look, this isn't going to work. I'm telling you, if you love the world, it's not going to work. If you actually put the world in a place that it shouldn't be, boy, it's not going to work. It says, if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. You ever hear somebody say, well, we just got to love one another? Well, if the love of the Father is in you, then you don't love the world. That's the way that is. Because if you love the world, the love of the Father isn't in you, and that's what it says. And if you change that, then that makes you an apostate. In other words, you're taking a principle and you're twisting it to be what you want it to be, not healthy. James 3:15. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. Seems like there's a division. There's this stuff on the earth that makes sense, and there's stuff to people who know Jesus that makes sense. And the stuff that Christians know that makes sense to them cannot make sense to those who don't know Jesus. See, that's the way it is, because they don't have the Spirit, they don't understand. That's why we live our lives as believers in public, because people can examine us then and say, you got something on your hand, what is it? You actually have a good marriage. You actually go out of your way to help you. What is it? I want that. See, that's different than just telling them a bunch of stuff. First John 5:19, we know that we are from God, and the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. There are believers today, people who name the name of Christ, who are so tied to the world in which we live, and they don't understand that it is the evil one that controls that. And then they're hoping that they do not get affected by it. There is no way not to be affected by this world, since the prince of the power of darkness rules it. There is no way, if you're too close to it, that you're not going to be affected by it. There is no way. You know, it's like somebody saying, I watch too much TV, and they just bought a brand new cable thing and an 85,000-inch curved television, and, you know, the whole works. I don't know, man, I just watch too much. You do. You see, you're so connected to this. And guess who rules that? And Satan actually understands how we think. He understands better than you and I understand. He knows how to manipulate us. He knows how to get into our heads. You know, Jay Cutler, sorry you Chicago fans, but all of us Wisconsin people think he should be the most valuable player. One of the things about Jay Cutler is you can get in his head. You can play with that man, and all of a sudden he can't throw a pass or anything. And every team knows it. They get in his head. And before you know it, he's throwing interceptions. He's doing things he shouldn't do. And you say, well, you're biased. Whatever. In football, part of the strategy of the game of football is getting into the other person's head. It isn't that you're bigger or stronger or faster. It's that you get into their head. When I played defensive end at Wheaton College, I was the same weight I was then, so I'm not a big guy. Everybody I played against was bigger than me by a lot. I had to figure out another way to win this thing. Because if it was just muscle on muscle, body on body, they'd kill me. So I did a lot of studying. Before we played, I would study. I'd figure out the guy's GPA, his classes, his girlfriend's name, his parents, everything. Everything I could find out about the guy. And right before the snap of the ball, I would say something to him. Like, so how's Matilda? And what I'm hoping is, just for a second, he's thinking, how do you know? And they snap the ball, and I get it by him. See, all I'm doing is getting into his head. Because I can't beat him. Satan can't beat God, but he can get into your head. And we let him. It's like, hey, Satan, I'm over here, man. Let's see if you can get into my head this way and that way and that way. You see, we know that we're from God. If you're a believer, you know you're from God. But if you know you're from God, then this world in which you live in is not of God. So why do you allow yourselves to be so tied to it? Basically, what I want to talk about is give you some quick symptoms this morning. Because some of you may not know that you need help. And that's the way I was. I have three major medical issues that I deal with. One is a heart condition. Another is I battled blood clots. I've had two of them. And one that went into the lungs that put me out for a while. And it was rather serious. And then I am narcoleptic. Now, what's interesting is the process in discovering all of that. Because it's not like you wake up one day and say, or not wake up in narcoleptic's case, and say, I'm narcoleptic, I need help. You don't do that. You go and you say, well, I'm tired. See, I have symptoms. And the symptoms play out a little bit. And after a while, people who are educated can take the symptoms and they go, I'll bet you know, and they guess. And then they take tests and they either confirm it or they don't. So that's real important. A lot of times, here's the first symptom in somebody's life that there's trouble. They don't have any of the fruits of the Spirit. Their lives are the fruits of the anti-spirit. They're angry, depressed, upset. Those are not fruits of the Spirit. See, those are symptoms that you need to look at now. Now, what is that telling you? That's the question. So when I went in the doctor at first, see, my first heart problems, I went in and it was heart issues. And my heart would beat irregularly, it would beat real fast, it would skip beats, it would pause. I went into the emergency room once when it was beating like 20 beats a minute and I couldn't get it to go faster. So my heart was going, you know, crazy. And what the doctor, the cardiologist determined was that I wore out my adrenal system. Because I get really excited about things. No, I don't. But that's what happened. My adrenal system was worn out for some reason. It wasn't functioning right. So you get pumps of it. You wouldn't get pumps of it. So then I got all this treatment for that stuff, you know, and I was doing that. And then down the road, I got a blood clot. Now, that wasn't related to anything, I don't think. But, you know, that was new. So that was now balanced. And even before that, what happened is I went to the doctor. He gave me some medicine to control the heart. And I was so tired. I said, Doc, I'm so tired, I quit that stupid medicine because I'm just too tired. I cannot stay awake on that stuff. He goes, well, just keep taking it, and you'll get used to it, you won't? All right, I tried again and I went back. I am so tired. He goes, you need to go check and see if you have sleep apnea. I said, I do not have it, I promise. I don't have those symptoms. I don't. And he goes, well, go check anyway and don't tell me. Fine. So you just need another $1 billion. So I go take the test, and I'm told, nope, you don't have it. I told you I didn't have it. But as I was walking out, the neurologist said, wait a minute, the symptoms, why don't we check you for narcolepsy? I said, come on, I'm 54 years old at the time. I wouldn't know if I had narcolepsy. So did everyone else. And he texted me, and he called me one night, about 10 o'clock at night, and he said, you have it. Now all of a sudden the pieces all fit. See, I've been narcoleptic. I've been spiking my adrenaline to stay awake. I've been drinking. I've ruined my adrenal system trying to. Now the pieces fit. Now they can treat me. Because now it's like, oh, that was the piece of the puzzle we were missing. Now we see it. Now we can treat you. So now I'm on these medicines for that. And now they're working at trying to get everything to work together correctly. So I think in our spiritual lives, we need to look and see the symptoms. And then if the symptoms are there, we need to do something with them and say, wow, we need to do something about that. Because they might be pointing to a certain disease. And if we want to ignore it, we can. And then what happens is you get taken by that disease eventually. Because you didn't get it checked or you didn't listen to those who knew what they were talking about. So I want to take a look at symptoms. First symptom, symptom number one is what I call unilateral listening. In other words, you really, it's like this. What I want and what I have to say are all that matters when we talk. We make decisions about what you want, your concerns, your feelings. These are mere whispers to me. You see, when the first issue that somebody really has a sign that there's an issue is that they're really not listening to anybody, including God. Everything's unilateral. Everything's, they're thinking about just alone in this world. I am it. My opinion, everything is what I'm thinking. Narcissistic listening dismisses, negates, ignores, minimizes, denigrates, or otherwise renders irrelevant other people's concerns. Why? Because you're putting it through your own filter of concerns. And you have no idea. You can't wait for the other person to be quiet so that you can tell them what they should think. You see, that's unilateral. You start thinking everything through your own filter as far as how it affects you and not everybody else. The Good Samaritan story in the Bible. There was one who said, you know what, this is going to affect me. I'm going to have to get dirty. I'm going to have to get dirty. Do you ever have to make that decision? You're going to have to get dirty about something. I mean, you're just going to have to. Just yesterday, we went and there was a car in the ditch, and we were with a guy with a four-wheel drive pickup truck, and this guy was in the ditch, and I'm telling you, he was not from this area. All right? He had Indiana license plates. He wasn't from this area. He's walking down the road, not dressed right, anything. And so we stop, and the guy looks, should we pull him out? Yeah, we should. You got a rope? Yeah, let's pull him out. So I get out, and there was slush all over the road. Man, these cars were coming, just spraying us with slush. They were going by. And I'm sitting there thinking, pfft. And the guy took the rope out and gave it to him, said, we need to hook that underneath. And the guy's looking like, uh-huh. All right. So I just took a dive under the car. Let's find a place to hook it. You see, there comes a time where you say, all right, I'm going in. It's going to cost me my cleanliness for a little bit. Unilateral thinking. Are you kidding me? Guy shouldn't have been doing that. Doesn't know how to drive. He's from Indiana. Doesn't know how to take these roads. No. While we were waiting for him to turn the truck around, I said, why are you helping? Because we love Jesus. And we help people who go in ditches around here. That's what you do. You help people go in ditches. No, he didn't come to Christ. There's no great ending to this story. You know how many cars went by this guy? You see, unilateral thinking. I did have my good coat on. My daughter said it was pretty funny because they were going, this guy got hit, sprayed with slush and went in his ear and all over the place. And yeah, it was that kind of environment. So many times spiritually, you know, if we're going to get involved in somebody's life, it gets messy. If we're really going to say something, instead of tolerate it, it gets messy. It gets messy. And we don't want to get messy. So in our unilateral way, we say, well, I got to take care of me, and that's all that matters. That's a sign that you have problems if you're so busy taking care of yourself that other people, or if you take care of somebody, you're waiting for that reward for doing it. The second one sounds like the first. It's a little different. The unilateral thinking is a little different than it's about me. It's about me is actually planning things to make sure that I get exalted somehow. You know, the average wedding in the United States is $28,000 right now. It's about me knowing more and knowing better and making sure that everybody knows that I know more and I know better. It's about honoring me in public. It's about making sure that I have the front row, that I get the best seat. This is no longer about the unilateral thing like the Good Samaritan. That was about getting dirty and that kind of thing. This is about, you know, I'm thinking of me all the time. And so, yeah, and we've promoted this in the church anyway. I mean, we pretty much say, give your 10% to God, that's fine. 90% is yours to really be selfish with. What if it's not that way? What if it's all God's, really, and you're a steward of it all? What if you're not supposed to trust money but trust God? What if those things are true instead of what we want to believe? But through the filter of these other things, it's all about me, then your work is all about you, and your money is all about you, and your family is all about you, and your decision-making process is all about you. And before you know it, you do really silly things just to make it all about you and make sure other people think that you're doing everything right. I once had a guy come, he was a financial advisor, and he came to the wrong guy because I don't have any finances to need advising for. But he was telling me, here's what you need. I did get some life insurance policy with him or something. But he said, yeah, but it's a life insurance policy in this kind of wrapper. And I looked at him and go, what are you talking about? Well, you know, the wrapper doesn't have to be what's really on the inside. Yeah. Yeah, you can wrap it and have it look this way, but it's really this way. Whatever. And I thought, yeah, that's how a lot of us are. We got this wrapper, but we're really somebody else. It's easy to do that. Ananias and Sapphira in the Bible, when you look at them, and you know, the idea of everyone in the church was really concerned about other people, and they were legitimately concerned for those people that had needs. And so they said, well, we can't be the only ones that aren't doing this, so let's go sell some property and kind of show, kind of be committed, sort of, almost. And they portrayed it as something as it wasn't, because they were all about themselves and exalting themselves, and that didn't work. In fact, that was the beginning of the church, really, and what happens is God said, that's not going to work, and he was very strict on that. They fell dead. Because they were pretending to be something, and it was really something that was just, it's really about me anyway. When I sell a piece of property, I if I'm going to give it away, there has to be horns and whistles and stuff, because it's really about me giving it away. Now, it's interesting up here through the years, this 47 years and going on 48 here, and there's been a lot of people, we depend on over $1,000 a day, 365 days a year for gifts, or we're not here. And there's no fundraising people, none of that stuff. And so we get gifts. And you know, we have gifts from people who I don't even know who they are, because they come anonymously. And we have gifts from people that if I don't acknowledge them in 24 hours, I am in big trouble. I've had people come to me and say, well, yeah, we could build this and I could see my name on it right now. I'm thinking, do you realize that we in the body of Christ, we that are part of the church, have made things what they really shouldn't be by just not saying anything? You see, if somebody comes and tells me that, you know what I like to tell them is, then why don't you keep your money? Because really, you need to give that money to God. Well, you're not a very good fundraiser, are you? No, I'm probably lousy. But the truth of the matter is that if we're silent, we accept that stuff. You see, somehow we have made even giving gifts about us. So there are parents that want their children to behave for them. Their life will be easier. Imagine that. Not only that, you know, it's even more interesting is we try to help people, but, and I call this premature forgiveness. You know, somebody does something, we make it spiritual, like, yeah, don't worry, I'm forgiving you no matter what. You know what? Sometimes we need to look at somebody and say, you need to go through this miserable period in your life. Why? Because you need to do this until you really repent. But I'm so spiritual, so I'll forgive you before you even ask. And what happens is we cannot let them off. The relationships are supposed to be so important that when somebody is excommunicated from a church, it drives them crazy because they're out from the body that they're supposed to be a part of. See, but we haven't made the body that important. In fact, because of my own self, I don't want to go correct somebody or warn somebody or say something that might hurt them. The truth is, I don't want to say something that's offensive or hurt somebody. That's true. But what if I go to a doctor and he says, you know, I really don't want you to change your lifestyle, really. I don't think that you've been doing anything wrong. You're a wreck, by the way. But I don't want to. You know, someone will come into my world here, my office, or talk to me, and their life's a wreck. And yeah, but I don't want to change anything. Well, then live your wrecky life. Because there's no way to get any better if you're going to keep making the same decisions. It's like going to God when you're beating your head on that rock, saying, God, please stop the headache. God's saying, quit beating your head on the rock. Oh, but God, you can make it so it doesn't hurt me, and you can make it so I don't want to beat my head on the rock. True. Enjoy the beating. What? Because when you beat your head on a rock, you get hurt. And the only way that you're going to be okay is understanding that you have the choice of quitting beating your head on the rock at this point. Unless you aren't a child of God in the first place and you don't have the Holy Spirit and you don't have the power of God over sin right now. You see, but when you make it all about me, it's not just all about me in the sense that I do make decisions, but it's all about me in the sense that I won't even correct you because it's too uncomfortable and too hard. And so we have a church that says love people, just, and what they mean is tolerate people in many senses. I think symptom number three is when we attempt to be the I am, God. We attempt to be God. You say that's hard. Well, here's how we do that. We make it so that rules don't apply to us the same way they apply to you. Do you realize that is true about God? That the things in life don't apply to him that apply to us necessarily? For example, God says, if you love me, you'll obey me. I could never throw that line at Linda and say, if you love me, you'll obey me. That doesn't work because I'm human, and that was a God thing. That there's a different deal there. God can actually do what he wants. Why? Because he's God. Not only that, but he always does right. Why? Because he's God. See, that's different already. So he does whatever he wants, he does whatever he wills, and it will be right when he does it. And somehow I want to do that. I want to live my life doing whatever I want, and it's right too. You see, that's the little I am syndrome. I want to make sure that, you know, we've seen this in presidential things. I can do this because I've got the power. Okay. It's interesting as you look at it, King Saul did that. If you look and see what he was doing when he offered the offerings himself, when he saw the people scattered, he said to Samuel as he came, when I saw people scattered and it wasn't being done, I'm king, I'll just do the offering. No, you weren't supposed to do it. You don't understand, I'm king, I'm in charge. I can do this. God will understand. Moses, you're supposed to speak to that rock, not strike it. Yeah, but you understand, these people are ornery and I'm in charge. No, I'm God, I told you something. Don't be playing God, I'm God. And you need to listen to me as God. It's interesting how we get to that point where rules don't apply to us. You ever realize what comes out of that? What comes out of that is the tax code in many ways. You know, we try and figure out how to have rules for everybody so that we can buy stop signs, but I don't want to pay my money. But we still need to buy stop signs. So I want you to buy them. And somehow I'm going to look good like I paid my taxes, but I really don't, because I figured out ways to make laws to benefit me so I don't have to do that. That becomes way too difficult of a life. The symptom number four I call flagrant have trouble with that word, but flagrant legalism. Often in disguise. It's interesting. Legalism is one of the shut up words in Christianity. If you're talking to somebody, well, that's legalistic, they're pretty much saying shut up. Another one is, you know, you're judging me. That's another one. Just be quiet. We don't want to hear you anymore. You have to get over that, because legalism is a very dangerous thing. Legalism are rules that benefit self and allow us to use relationships. In other words, I'm going to figure out a way to use the tax system for my benefit and use you to buy the stop sign. It's going to appear that I also am in that pool. But I figured out a way not to pay it. And you're a chump because you're paying your taxes. And then what you get is a Talmud, or you get a tax code that's about that thick that nobody can read. Because we all want to abide by it and look like good, honoring citizens, but we're just not wanting to pay any taxes. See, I want to be a good, solid Christian, but not necessarily obey God. But I need to set it up so I can be. The Pharisees did that in the Talmud. I mean, they had all these rules to make it look like they loved God. They even caught Jesus breaking the Sabbath. But he wasn't. But they caught him. Because he was breaking their rules. And he told them that. I'm breaking your rules, but I'm not breaking the Sabbath. Because the rules weren't about that. Do you know that rules are good in the context of relationships? They're not bad. They're good. See, in other words, I'm married, so I make rules about being married. I'm not going to go to dinner with another woman, you know, without Linda. That's a good rule. Now, if I'm a single guy and I make that rule, that doesn't make any sense. But if I'm a married guy, that makes sense. I'm not going to travel alone with another woman that I'm not related to. Not, you know, my daughters are fine, my wife, but no one else. Oh, wait, no, you know what? I have a relationship I'm protecting. So within the context of the relationship, I set a rule. Now, you can call me a legalist if you want, but the deal is it's not being driven by the rule, it's being driven by the relationship. So if I don't want to watch something on television or listen to some music, whatever, I'm not a legalist, I'm protecting the relationship I have with God. See, that's different. And we have to understand that there are things that would draw us away from God. And Satan knows what they are, so he's clever. So when we make a rule, we're not legalists. Unless we start thinking that the rule makes us better than somebody else, I mean, you're in trouble there. Not only that, legalism has different variables to it. It's like this. It's what I was talking about yesterday and today is it's all or nothing, isn't it? You're all in or you're not in. It's not sort of, kind of, almost in. And so here, you go to a movie. You decide you're going to go to a movie. What movie are you going to go to? How many curse words are okay? How many sexual innuendos? How many? You are going to draw a line somewhere. That's what makes you a legalist when you draw that line. Because the standard, if you're in a relationship with God, is none of it. But you say, wait a minute, that's too hard. I'm not going to do none of it. Exactly. We as a culture have already deviated from that. So we're not going to do that. We're going to do some of it and make it okay. So in a relationship sense, you can ask the same question. You know, I could go ask Linda, how much unfaithfulness will be acceptable in our marriage? The answer is zero. That's a very narrow margin. Yeah, but that's all that's acceptable. Okay? I can't be like 95% faithful and still be a good husband? I mean, 95, that's an A. I mean, think about it. No. One acceptable score, 100%. Yeah, but Dave, really, we're going to sin. We are, aren't we? So let's just do it. It's like the batter again. We're only going to hit one out of three, so let's just plan on not hitting this one. That's not how we live. You see, flagrant legalism starts putting rules out there. And then they look at others down their nose like, you're the legalist because you wouldn't even go to that movie. You said no. You wouldn't even go to it. See, I go to it. You know, I'm on a bandwagon against alcohol. I think the church is going to be in big trouble. So don't ever come to me and say you think the Bible authorizes alcohol because I'll disagree with you. And not only that, I don't even need the Bible. I'll give you one example. There's a retired sheriff in Arizona that said in his 30-some years of service, he never made an arrest that wasn't alcohol-related. Alcohol does not make our nation better. Mayo Clinic recently came out and said, if drinking doesn't have any benefit, do not do that. You know why it's working, though? Because the church is so immersed in what's going on the screen and what's normal in society, and nobody's saying anything, saying, yeah. You do realize this. I'll give you one pointer. In the Bible, in the New Testament, the word wine, there's one word only used for grape juice, wine, whatever. Any grape product has one word. You have to put the context to it. I'll leave it there. Just because in our heads it's a certain way doesn't mean that, you know, that's the way it was. The bottom line, I'll tell you the principle. If you're using alcohol to help you relax, do something else, where's the spirit in your life, and what are we doing? And what are we passing to the next generation? Because I am personally tired of dealing with the ramifications of people drinking too much and ruining their lives and then coming back trying to get help. That's not even a good idea without the Bible. Oh yeah, but you don't understand. I know, unilateral thinking, it's all about me, I like how it tastes, fine, go ahead. But the bottom line really is, it's not something that's helping our society. It's not something that helps us fight better the battle that takes place in the mind. And what we can do is we can become legalists. So the question is, since we're not supposed to allow alcohol to control our mind at all, where's the line for you? Now you become a legalist, you can have two drinks, or you can, whatever, fine. And you can do that and you feel good, but if you go one more drop than that, then you better feel bad because you just did bad things. Really. You know, it's interesting, this flagrant legalism that's in disguise. We disguise it as a freedom when it's a legalism. There are legalists that will make a bunch of rules, like the Pharisees, and say, if I live this way, this way, this way, this way, this way, then God loves me more. That's evil. That's wrong. I'll tell you right now, no matter where you are in your life, God loves you. That's the issue. He can't love you more. He can't love you less. That you can't do anything to make him love you more or less. The rules aren't going to do it. No. Why should you even live according to some of the standards say no to this flesh? Well, because I said earlier, the one who rules this world and flesh is not God. The one who keeps coming at us in the passions of the flesh isn't God. And he's just looking for that open door. For some of us, it's internet connections, and for some of us, it's movies, some of it's alcohol, some of it's, you know, laziness, whatever it might be, but he's looking for that open door. You know, we used to not really care how we beat the other guy when we played football against him. We just need to beat him. We wanted to do whatever we could. It didn't matter within the rules to beat them. And we used to have a play, if I couldn't handle the guy, in high school I played offensive line as well, we used to have a play, if the team that we were playing was really big and they could handle our offensive line, we changed our strategy. We let them go wherever they wanted to. That may sound like a bad strategy, but it was a good strategy. So the guy in front of me, he would come after me. Whatever way he was going, I would just get him and keep pushing him that way. And our quarterback would hand the ball off to the running back way deep in the backfield and say, look for the openings. See, it was a play that worked marvelously. Why? Because I just took the guy, we just took the people wherever they were going and kept pushing them that way. And they're going, what is this? And what in the process, if you look at from a film, you see all these openings take place. Because we were just taking them wherever they went. And our running back was just running all over the place. We're laughing at him, saying, yeah, go ahead, try it again, come at me. And they come at me and I keep pushing them away, they're going. It's like the easiest thing I ever did in my life. The trouble is when they caught onto it and stopped, now I'm going, oh, now I got to move you. You're too big to move. You see, Satan does that with us. I don't know what the issue is, but he does that. And then we disguise it with rules, legalism, kind of stuff. No, you're either all in or you're not in. You're either listening to God or you're not listening to God. You're not sort of, kind of, almost. I know some of these things say, well, that's a little controversy, television, whatever. You know what's happened is we're into the legalists go into the 2 Timothy 4 passage, where Paul tells young Timothy, you're going to be a pastor, and here's how you do it. You're going to preach the word, and you're going to reprove, rebuke, and exhort. Those three things. Not one, not two, but three. You're going to do those three things. And then he goes, but do it patiently, because people are going to find teachers with itching ears. They're going to find somebody to say what they want to say. If you want to find somebody that says opposite of what I say, you will spend about 5 minutes on the internet, you can find them. The issue isn't really to listen to Dave Wager or to any other speaker or to anybody else. The issue is to open the Bible and listen to what God says and see if what he says is something you are choosing to apply or ignore. It's to try and discover God, not create him. It's trying to discover truth, not make truth. And when you're legalistic, you can have two ends of this thing. You can be legalistic with a bunch of rules and not have any relationship at all. You can be legalistic and be one. You know, I could tell you this right now, that I could say things like, yeah, and I really love Linda, my wife, but I'm going to golf every day off that I have. I'm going to golf every single day. And every moment when I'm not golfing, I'm going to be reading golf magazines. And you might look at me and say, you certainly have the freedom to do that, but I doubt you're going to have a very good relationship with Linda. Are you telling me I don't love my wife? Because you're just one. Go ask her. And you ask her, yeah, he doesn't spend any time with me. Well, you don't know. Wait, she's the one you're talking about. But you're telling me I can't love golf and her? If the word love is, yeah, I am. In this case, you know, so then you want me to be legalistic and say I'm only going to golf once a month? Yeah. It's not legalism at that point. You're making a rule because you love somebody. When will the church again make rules because we love God? That's all. Not because we're trying to be better or trying to... When will we make rules because we love God and because we love other people? One of my big things on alcohol is I'm not going to touch it because there's a bunch of young men that I work with and I will never give them the okay to touch that stuff. Never. You say, no, I'm in a position where I'm not going to do that. See, because I'm going to make a decision based on them and based on what I think is right as far as giving them an example in life. Now, you can call it legalism if you want, but it's based on relationship, I just told you. This legalism thing is tough, and it's a symptom that's tough. It's hard to see sometimes. Legalism breeds a sense of entitlement that turns us into complainers. See, we complain a lot if you're a legalist because you've got all these rules that nobody else is keeping. Or you went to a movie and you have rules, but they went to the next one, and they had one more less rule, so they could watch that one, but you couldn't. It's a symptom. Symptom five. This is an interesting one when our concerns for people are turned into criticisms. In other words, as a parent, maybe I might be talking to my children about something, and they say, well, you don't like me. No, I have a concern for something. See, but when we turn concerns into criticisms, that's a symptom of a problem. That's Stephen in the Bible. Do you ever read that passage where Stephen is talking? And I'll bet you to a certain point, the people in the crowd are going, amen. He's reviewing their history with them. And it's a good one. And then all of a sudden it's like, and you stiff-necked, ooh, no more amens. Why? You're criticizing us. Was he criticizing them or was he giving them a message from God that they needed to hear? You know, one of the things we do is really surround ourselves with too many people that are just like us. You need to have people in your life that see things opposite you. So you need to have those people in your life. Now, you know, I always say this in my head anyway, and to some of the young guys I mentor, you should have friends that you would not want to go out to dinner with. Why? Because they can be your most valuable friends. They need to ask you hard questions. They need to wonder why you did things. They need to think differently than you. If you are going to surround yourself with everybody just like you, you will never be challenged the way you should be. You see, not only that, the way that happens, though, is you turn somebody's concern into a criticism enough, and they quit being concerned. In other words, if somebody comes to you and says, man, I'm really concerned, you're staying up too late. Oh, you and your rules. I'm really, you're tired all the time. You're staying up. You don't understand. Before you know it, they quit telling you. Why? Because you turn it into a criticism. You won't even let the people that love you be concerned for you. Boy, that's dangerous. There are a few people in your life that will love you enough to tell you the truth. Don't push them away. But we do. We tend to minimize who they are. We hear others' attempts to talk about us. Our personal feelings are veiled with criticisms of themselves. So we begin to just think, well, you're a bum. You know, it's like when I was growing up, I don't know, the saying when I was a kid, if you were going to insult a kid on the playground, was your mom wears army boots. I don't know why, it just was what it was. And so you would be talking to a kid and you'd get mad at him. He'd look at you like, yeah, well, your mom wears army boots. It's like, what's my mom have anything to do with anything? You see, somehow you took whatever they were saying and you moved it to another plane. And now you're just insulting each other. We don't like Stephen, let's kill him. We don't like Jesus, let's kill him. But that'll solve the problem. Certainly did what Stephen taught. We don't know anything about it today. Yes, we do. I don't know what the crowd taught. I didn't know who they were. We know one of them, the Apostle Paul, who was Saul back then. And he had to learn a lesson. I'll bet you that day with Stephen was a turning point. My own, it's not in the Bible, just my own speculation. He watched Stephen take it on the chin. And then God just struck him down. And I'll bet you that all played into what he understood. So even as the disaster of Stephen was going on, even as the misunderstandings were going on, see, I actually think Saul was a guy who loved God in his head, but he was wrong. He was trying to defend the God that he knew. He was trying to defend things. He wasn't trying to be a jerk, but he was. See, it's that kind of thing. That's the kind of symptoms we're looking for to try and get rid of them. And God had to bring it to him in a way that he got it. He had to strike him down on the road to Damascus. You get it now? Very few people have been beat into the kingdom, but he's one of them. You see, we have to be careful if we turn people's concerns into criticisms of me. It is one of my favorite tactics, by the way. If Linda says something, I go, you don't like me. You know what? I know she likes me. I throw that line out to just get her quiet. Why? Because I'm turning the concern into a criticism. We do that with God as well. Number six. I think I only have seven, so we're almost there. When things go wrong between us, it's always your fault. We don't take personal responsibility for anything. Adam and Eve. Adam, blame God. You know, after they sinned, Adam said, the woman, who you gave me, made me sin. God goes, nice try. Adam, you sinned because you chose to sin. You take personal responsibility. Oldest book in the Bible, I believe, is Job, very last chapter of Job. Job takes personal responsibility for what he believes. He could have blamed his three buddies. He didn't. He took personal responsibility. He said, surely I believe things. You know, picture it one day. You stand before God. And God says, are you my family? You go, well, my great-grandmother said if I get $50 a week, I'd have everything covered. And my grandmother agreed, my mother agreed, I did it, here I am. And God goes, well, they were all wrong. Now where are you standing? Well, let me recheck this. No, they were wrong, you're wrong. Yeah, but I didn't have a chance. They were wrong, you're wrong. Everybody that's sitting in this room, you are personally responsible for what you believe. And just because you believe something doesn't make it truth. You can believe something that's not true. Go ahead. The problem is, you're not going to have the fruit of the Spirit in that. You're going to have the fruit of unrighteousness in that. It can be masked for a while. If you have a lot of money and you want to live for yourself, and you want to buy a bunch of filet mignon and eat it all the time or something, you're going to be happy for a few moments. But you're going to have to keep buying that meat, and you're going to have to keep... And you're going to find out eventually that it doesn't work. See, we're quick to blame, slow to appreciate. I am this way because of you, because of that, because of my illness, because of whatever, you know. In many ways, I've been blessed with the narcolepsy and some of the things I have. Because I've always been confronted now since understanding that with a choice. I can either blame that disease for problems, or I can understand that I have it and live within the context of it. I can do one or the other. But I get to choose. And at moments, I don't mind blaming it. Right, it looks softer on me. I can't be expected to apologize for something. I need to blame somebody for it. Now, if we don't take personal responsibility for who we are, you know, if you're not in the physical shape you want to be, own it, would you? Go do something different than you did last year. And not just for January. You know, change some things. See, we need to own the issues, not shift the blame. The seventh and the last one. People make me mad. If people make you mad, that's a symptom of a problem. I don't know how many times I've joked at church and things are working and the kids have messed up. I'd be, man, this may be so great without these kids. We wouldn't have any messes. We wouldn't have any work. We wouldn't have any, you know, we could just have this perfect environment. Because they come in and everything gets messed up right away. Oh, yeah, that's why we're doing that. I forgot. Remember Ahab, he saw Naboth's vineyard in 1 Kings 21. That man makes me mad. Why? I want his vineyard. You won't give it to me. I said, well, let's get him killed. Oh, yeah, that'll work. Yeah, people make us mad. They get in our way. You know what the opposite is, what happens to those who love Jesus, really? They look for ways to make other people successful, even at their own expense. They are thrilled to look at somebody and make them the best they can be, even if it costs them. People don't make them mad. At camp here, we train a lot of young people. If you haven't, you know, we have the Nicolet Bible Institute, we have summer staff. There are some young men and women come up here, they've never driven like a stick shift before, and they've never driven a dump truck before. So this is their first experience. Needless to say, our vehicles take a beating. I remember one year, there was a young man up here who didn't drive stick shift, and he was real nervous. He was backing up the dump truck. And as he did, the door on the other side was open, and it jarred on a tree. And he said, oh, no. And he got out, and he got back in, shifted it wrong. His door was open and jarred the other one. So now he's got two doors that don't shut. And he came, and he had his head down in his tummy. Dave, I'm sorry. I can't believe it. He said, oh, that's funny. You know, I'm sorry too, because truth of the matter is you probably should have shut the doors and looked. But I bet you'll never do that again. He goes, I promise. You know, when you're after their success, we understand failure. That's not the end. Often failure is the springboard that we need to help teach them. And they look for somebody that understands that in their life. And when people make us mad because we are now inconvenienced, because they didn't think the way they should, because they weren't doing what they should, when they make us mad, that's a symptom. We need to be looking for those opportunities. Well, I remember I was cleaning up once a mess that the students made, and someone walked in and said, you shouldn't be doing that. I just smiled, like, you're right. But I said, you know what I figured? I figured whoever left this mess could care less about everybody else but themselves. Because when you leave a mess, what you're saying to the people that come behind you is, my schedule, my everything was so important that I'm just too busy to clean up after myself, and I'm just leaving. So you stop your schedule and take care of it. Or I'll clean it up when I get my free time and you have to live with the mess. And I'm thinking, yeah, well, I'm not mad. I'm just telling you why I'm cleaning it up. Because it's really not about the mess, it's about people. And if you love people, you're thinking about what God says and you're thinking about how you can make them successful. And how you can show them they're important. And they don't make you mad. Now, do you need to teach them a lesson once in a while? Yes. Sometimes it's probably appropriate, if you can, to just shut the door and let them live in it. Until they get terrible germs from it all. But there's other times in public where you need to step in. You see, these are just symptoms. And as I went through them, You know, you could look at them and justify whatever. These are symptoms. And the terrible thing of being a speaker is I could, you know, the only life I can tell is mine. So I've taken these symptoms from my life, basically. So here's things that show I'm in trouble. And when you're in trouble, you need help. There is help. And what we're going to spend the rest of the three sessions we have on is the answers to these. But I wanted to make sure we understood what the question was before we get to the answers, if that makes sense. And I do have 7 issues here, and I'm going to have 8 answers. So I don't know how that works. But I'll probably have more answers by the time we're totally done, because they keep coming. But I do want you to know that God loves us right now, where we're at. We have to start thinking in terms of Him and others. And start thinking in terms of how can I use my life and invest it rather than just live it. And we're going to talk more about that in the sessions to come. So let's pray.